in this nice group of people could say how to tune 20 kilohertz signal into 50 ohm, which is transmitter, transmission line, and the antenna, or the ham radio 17.6, 17 kilohertz 0.6, or 137 kilohertz, 127 kilohertz, right. How you can do it? How those guys dealing with 60 or 50 hertz power line are able to tune 50 hertz to make the measurements so that communication between one tower and the second tower, or one station and the second station at the distance of 20 miles or 30 miles is able to be maintained? How you can deal with the signal that is on the high voltage line? That's what signal crafters is about. So if those guys who have a magnetic loop antenna, or they have a high voltage or antennas, or antennas that have a high capacitive component in it, and they operate with high voltages, now you have a solution. Intuition.
Okay, but it was getting back to people like Rich with magnetic loops. It's not the loop itself that is being tested. It's the measurements coming off of the coupling loop that doesn't get that high voltage potential that works with most readily available amateur radio components. So, yeah, if suddenly you wake up one morning and find yourself a lineman for a commercial utility for electrical power, you might be asked that question, but I put it to you, in your many years of amateur radio, how many times did this need kind of come up in your hobby?
When it goes to the VLF frequencies, all the time. You cannot measure the impedance of the transmission line on the kilohertz range. There are no devices that could do it. Well, you could do it possibly, eventually, but try to make it with the signal on it. Enter Xia.
Well, perhaps, but again, you basically have a 40-year-old piece of technology that you could only buy used because there's not enough demand for it to manufacture it, even though the company is still around, and I'm sure they still have plans. For loafer, they call it loafer operation, which is somewhat esoteric. There are not a great deal of low-frequency amateur radio operators out there. I think that there are far more microwave experimenters than there are low-frequency, but to each their own. So if you find yourself needing to figure out the impedance of a transmission line and you're somehow operating at very ultra-low frequencies, then I guess this is the tool for you. Since I don't do low frequency, it doesn't really impact me, and I like the bells and whistles of the 21st century. So given the choice 1,000 times between the Signal Crafters and my LP500, I think that short of suffering from some kind of alcohol toxicity, I would pick the LP500, but that's me. That's just me. Everyone to their own.
Absolutely agree with you, Dr. Ryan. Absolutely. I'm working on different kind of communication. The GoBow transmission line, which is actually a wire covered with the Teflon, with the electric, and the signal travels in the 2D, two-dimensional space between the wire and Teflon that is covering it. That is nothing new. It was 1956 when GoBow made it, and plenty of guys conform it. It works, but it is nothing like a surface wave. So that would actually make me happy when I'm dealing with it. Now, making another communication when you have a 200 feet of the aluminum foil on your backyard, and you have that's the conductive medium, and then you have air, which is the dielectric. Now you have your interface. Now making a communication between point A and point B. It's interesting. It's something new. You don't have that electromagnetic energy in the air. You have it in the interface. It's similar to the cobalt line, but the only difference is that you don't use the wire. You use something thicker than the wire, and it's the same mechanism. So that's why I'm trying to use frequencies lower than they usually use. Ham radio operators, there was one, the Dick was alive at that time. There was one guy, I could send you the call sign, who was making about 400 feet communication from point A to point B. And actually, at the end, he decided that he wants to put a 100-watt light bulb at the end of it. So he sent the signal strong enough, so from the other side of the cobalt line, that the light bulb was giving the light, and full light. But you need to have, again, impedance match for it, and you have a pretty high voltage there. So this is what I'm doing. This is what makes me happy. Back to you.
Okay, so you're basically experimenting with things similar to G-line. We've talked about G-lines in the past. You certainly had more than a few conversations with Dick, may rest in peace, about G-lines and esoteric waveguide designs that limit the amount of attenuation along the transmission line. So I wish you luck on it. I was thumbing through the manual. The directional coupler that comes with that Model 30 is a run-of-the-mill 1.8 to 30 megahertz, 50, 52 ohm, 2 kilowatt directional coupler. So, I mean, you could get a single slug for your bird watt meter that has that rating. It won't be as accurate for low power signals because they're rated according to the maximum, power output type of thing. But it's doable. So I wish you well with your transmission line experiment.
Thank you very much for that. Well, actually, I have a problem with your comment because this directional coupler connected to that device that is a multifunctional device. It could go for 2 meters and 80 centimeters. As you wish, you only change the extra coupler. It could work with very low power. QRP, it could work with kilowatts of power. You don't have that with bird meter. You either buy 2-watt plug or you buy 1,000-watt plug or 10-kilowatt plug. And it costs money. So if you compare that, how much was it? $150 for the device, but nobody wants to sell it any longer. So if you have such a device, now you have a whole range of options that you don't have with virtual watt meter. Back to you. Thank you.
Well, I mean, my understanding is with this device, you have to change the directional coupler in the same way that you have to change the bird meter's plug. If you want to operate 1.8 to 30 megahertz, you could use the HF231 directional coupler that apparently comes with this model. Otherwise, you would have to buy a different coupler and unscrew it and screw it in. So effectively, the coupler is just an analogy of the bird watt meter plug. Pick the one, half a dozen of the other.
No, with the exception that you don't have to be worried about high power or low power. You have the same directional coupler, and the power switching
from QRP to kilowatt is being done inside of the SWR target?
Well, I mean, theoretically, yes, but I have kind of problems with a directional coupler that's designed for 2 kilowatts, but the accuracy is dependent upon the settings in the box as opposed to the coupling design accuracy. So, you know, I mean, I'm never going to have that device, so I'm not going to be able to put it on a lab table and check if it truly is plus or minus the 6% for, you know, if you set it for the 20-watt setting, or if, you know, what they mean by that is it's plus or minus 6% at the maximum 2-kilowatt setting. So I don't know.
Okay. We have another gentleman waiting in line. I do thank you very much for letting me talk about this device. I'm thrilled with that. And how much is left? I'm not the youngest guy any longer in this group of people. And to Exane, thank you very much. To Roy, thank you very much, everybody.
You're welcome, Wesley. Jim, do you want to do your topic tonight, or do you want to save it for next week? Whatever you want.
I'll throw it out there. This is KD2VHD, Jim, from Bayport, halfway to Montauk on the right side, if anybody's interested. I'm going to drop it and see if I got it. So last week there was some interesting conversation about the lost submersible, and lots of technical accusations of impropriety and unprofessionalism and poor safety, and all of those things have complete merit. I think there's a lot of questions that are hard to answer as far as what happened from the technical standpoint of that thing. But as I was listening last week to the conversation, I was a little confused because the guy that did this thing, the CEO of the name here, Rush, Stockton Rush, he doesn't strike me as a wheeling motorcyclist on the Belt Parkway. This was a much more substantial situation. I'm drawn to wonder what on God's good earth was his motivation? Because there was some powerful motivation. I'm going to let it drop for a second. Something was driving this guy to do this, more than the motorcyclist doing wheelies on the Belt Parkway. Something else was going on here to drive this guy to this wild, wild extreme. I was wondering if there was anybody that had any thoughts on that. Because I'm confused. Back to that.
AC2GS. Okay, Jim. Well, it's my understanding. I certainly didn't know the guy. And he was a bit of an adrenaline junkie. He had aspired to be a jet pilot. I think he had poor vision, which kind of meant that he could not join the Air Force and be a pilot. So he decided to point his adrenaline from the sky to the ocean. He got very obsessed with the Titanic, like many people do, and he thought that he could cut enough corners to make tourism for things like the Titanic possible. What usually costs a lot more for present-day submersibles that are made out of titanium and interesting but expensive alloys, he thought he could build them out of carbon fibers and laminate. And he was willing to risk his life, and unfortunately others, he had them sign legal forms that, you know, if this kills you, you don't blame me. And he poo-pooed everyone who issued comments about risk. And many, many, many people did. James Cameron, who actually went down and helped to photograph the Titanic wreck, sent them emails that he disparaged. Specialists in the field did, just about everyone and their brother did. And his attitude was noblesse oblige. You know, you guys don't know how to, that being alive means taking risks. Well, you know, there are risks you take because you want to be alive, and there are risks that you don't take because you would like to stay alive.
Good points all. I've taken many, 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 many risks in my life, and some of them far, far greater than most people would do. Always had a good reason for doing them. Never found a good reason to jump out of a perfectly good plane. If I had a good reason to jump out of a bad plane, I would be happy to do it. But something doesn't fit about this story. It just doesn't fit. There's more motivation than just carelessness here, in my estimation. And I was wondering if anybody had anything other to add to that.
Well, certainly I'll open it up to the rest of the people listening. It was a business venture for him. He was going to make money off of this. I believe initially a few years ago it was $125,000 a trip. That doubled this year. So the father-son group paid $500,000 to get themselves killed. So, you know, he was an entrepreneur. He came from a multiple generation of business people looking to make a fortune, and he thought that this would be a profitable venture on his part. So you have hubris in general, risk-taking. If you take it for yourself, so be it, but if you take it on for other people, I got a couple of problems, and the need to succeed. But I'll open it up to the rest of you people out there. If you have any comments to make, please feel free. Well, Jim, I guess that sums that up.
Understood. I will continue to wonder. Something doesn't seem right to the story to me. It just doesn't seem just like a careless fly-by-night would have gotten that far. Notwithstanding that there was definitely many, many shortcomings to the adventure. Agreed. Okay, thanks for humoring me. I appreciate it. Back to that. KD2VHD.
No, no problem, Jim. I appreciate your participation as always. Human beings do wacky things. I'm sure he believed utterly to his dying second that it was an acceptable risk for him and for his customers. And there are people who are excessive risk takers, and because they tend to be lucky, they survive a lot of risks until the day that they don't. So, you know, seldom in my experience do risky people who live risky lives lose their lives on the first risk. They seem to have a few get-out-of-jail cards hidden away when they're born. So I think it's just as simple as that. He cut way too many corners. He used the design unproven. He had no way of proving that each cycle submersed and back to the surface would not destroy, you know, corrupt the layer effect of the carbon fibers. And ultimately, I think it was submerged 6 or 7. That was the one that was one too many. So, you know, a lot of things have expiration dates and expiration cycles. Things are designed sometimes to be used X number of times and no more. And without proper investigation and not knowing how many times you could do something with a piece of equipment, you overuse it, it breaks. And most times you're just left throwing it in the garbage and being annoyed. In this case, a lot more heartache occurs. But, you know, we'll see. I'll keep my eye on the news to see if there's anything new and interesting. I'm not really expecting much, but we'll see.
Comment?
Yes, Wesley.
Yesterday I saw a video that is on YouTube which actually analyzed how much pain and suffering would have anyone who is in submarine that implodes or explodes. So I've learned from that the submarine is going down uncontrollably. It's going to happen to it the same as it happened to that batiscaf or whatever we call it, device that took life of rich people. But interesting a comment of some people skilled in art, scientists, was that never, of the people who died in such implosions ever experienced it. And I was like, how is it possible? They died, right? How come they never experienced it? Well, they were analyzing also the implosion of the tanker, but then not tanker on the ship, but on the railroad, the tanker that the heavy big bottle, how do you call it, the container that is usually carrying on the liquid, and they made a controllable implosion. It took less than 35 milliseconds. So 35 milliseconds, then our body, you are Dr. Roy, what that was the claim that if you touch something hot, it takes a little time before the signal goes to your brain, and then you feel the pain. There are some situations when that signal could be processed even for a few seconds, and here we have a 35 milliseconds. That's why the claim was none of those soldiers that died this way, not of those submarine crew, not of anybody who was in the submarine or whatever the device, otherwise it imploded due to the pressure, ever experienced that, because they didn't have a time to even think about it. Back to you.
Comment.
Yes, please, comment.
I believe that the YouTube video that Wes is referring to was an episode of MythBusters in which they imploded the tank car. I would point out that it didn't flatten like a pancake. It imploded into two conic sections that were, it was touching in the middle. And unless you happen to be standing right where the two sections came together, you did not get killed instantaneously. If you were in either of the sides, you had some moments of existence as the water poured in on you. I find it specious for anyone to say, oh, the people in these situations didn't experience anything. It's not a reasonable statement to make. This is KC2FYJ.
Yes, Harry, thank you for that. Well, I don't know if we'll ever know. They pulled a lot of the bits and pieces up from the ground. They'll be doing a lot of research. I think they've found human remains of some sort in it. It depends upon how quickly the shock waves. If there was kind of instantaneous complete failure of the carbon fiber pressure seal, and then that pressure wave might have gone at such a fast speed that it overcame the speed of neurotransmitters. Different nerves conduct signals at different rates. Pain is a very primitive designed nervous system, so that I'm sure people out there have had experiences where they drop something, it falls on their big toe, they feel the pressure of it because the pressure sensors run faster, and then a fraction of a second later, they feel excruciating pain when the pain signal arrives. So it takes time for nerve endings to communicate with the brain, and then there's an actual latency period in our brain where we process it and bring it into our consciousness, that we are blissfully unaware that we are on a slight delay in our brain. We think that things are happening in real time. At least our consciousness thinks that that's happened. So I don't know. It's no good. If they felt pain, if they didn't feel pain, they're still unfortunately dead. And they're going to be dead for a long, long time. I understand that. But, you know, I think it's terrible for the families that they left behind. But thrill seekers got a thrill seek. Anyway, thanks everyone who participated tonight. As always, I'm very appreciative. You guys make or break a technical net. You don't want to hear me do a monologue. I certainly don't want to hear me do a monologue. So, thank you all. I'll be back a little later, but now I have to apologize to Paul once again for being late. But once again, this SpaceNet report with Paul WS2N.
AC2GSWS2N. What is the SpaceNet report for the TechNet? Very good. And I'm thinking about that submarine. If it was financial, I still haven't seen one report on how much did it cost to build this thing, this whole business. Because, you know, if he was going to be the pilot on most of the trips down to the Titanic, and you put four people in and at $250,000 each, that's $1 million every time he goes down. So how much did it cost to build that thing? You know, so you'd have to figure. Once you had that information, then you would know if it was really financial or not. Anyway, by the way, I heard he also wanted to be an astronaut at one time, but wasn't able to make it. I don't know the reason why he didn't make it, but you know, he gave that a shot as well. Let me just go through a few things here. We got some time. This is WS2N. Yesterday, there was a launch that I watched because, you know, it was something we talked about on the net for years. Every now and then, the Euclid mission. The Euclid mission is a European Space Agency project. Their goal was to actually launch this thing on a Soyuz rocket from Kourou, French Guiana, in South America. But that fell through due to the war in the Ukraine. With the Soyuz rocket, you know, they need Russian people to handle that over in Kourou. So you know, that's all been stopped. So they needed to figure out what they were going to do, and they contacted SpaceX, and they had to make some adjustments on the adaptive system between the two rockets. It was different. They all worked it out, and this all happened very quickly. They actually signed a final contract to do this between the European Space Agency and SpaceX back in January. Here we are now July. But it successfully went off yesterday from Florida, and it's on its way. It left a little after 11 o'clock in the morning. Let me drop it. Launched on a Falcon 9 rocket, not an extra heavy one, just a regular Falcon 9. The first time that SpaceX is going to this particular location in space, it's going to the L2 location, or Lagrange Point 2. That's the one that's 1 million miles away from the Earth, roughly four times the distance of the Moon. And out in the area where the James Webb Space Telescope is hanging out, as well as the Gaia. Gaia is another mission that was sent out years ago by the European Space Agency, and a couple of other ones that have been there in the past. So it's going to take a while to get there, just like James Webb took about a month to get to that location. This one will take about a month as well. And then after they reach this halo orbit, this telescope that has a mirror a little bit bigger than 4 feet in diameter will go through a one-month commissioning process to become operational. The idea of Euclid is to map, well, they said like one-third of the sky. That's what they're hoping for over a six-year period. They intend on going back tens of billions of years, about 10 billion years back, with millions, if not billions, of galaxies that are going to be mapped on this telescope. Two main instruments. There's a regular camera type of instrument that's going to send actual pictures back, and then there's a photometer system that's going to be recording all these lights in the sky, and they need to do it over time. The idea is to create a three-dimensional space picture of whatever they're looking at. Now, once they have that 3D look, and over time, you know, it could be adjusted, but they can tell which way things are moving. They're going to use the redshift, they have that capability to know what this looks like now and what it looked like in the past and what it looks like in the future. By mapping this out, the main goal of everything is with the Euclid is to investigate dark matter and dark energy. So, interesting flight. They had it on the NASA TV, and they would switch over to the European Space Agency, and they had scientists there explaining everything. Very well done. And then they would switch back over to NASA TV, and they were actually rebroadcasting SpaceX, the SpaceX feed. So, good launch, and we'll see how they do. It's an infrared system, infrared telescope, so it has to be cold, not to the extremes of space James Webb Space Telescope. But it does have to, stay relatively cold. And even at that distance, there is a temperature in space. But they don't have to go to the extremes of James Webb. James Webb in the same location, but they actually have a refrigeration system on board to bring the temperatures even lower, closer to absolute zero. That's not necessary on Euclid. And once this is up and running, a few years from now, I think it's 2027, they plan on NASA plans on launching another telescope called Nancy Roman Telescope, which will also go out to the Lagrange Point 2 and complement the investigation of Euclid. And between the two of them, they should be able to get a lot of information, try to figure out what this is all about with dark energy and dark matter. Any comments or questions? WS2N. Okay, very good. And there was another interesting space, let's call it a launch, but I call it more of a flight, on June 29th, which was last Thursday. And that was out of Spaceport America, New Mexico. The Virgin Galactic company got around to launching the Unity ship. This time they put six people into space. They have a commander and a pilot always on their vehicles. And then they had a crew of four that successfully launched on the Mothership Eve. Mothership is a two-fuselage unit. It's jet-powered, and they attach Unity to the bottom of it. They got up to around 35,000, or they said 45,000 feet, I think, in this case. And they drop Unity like a bomb, and 2 seconds later, its hybrid engine ignites and starts to head vertical, really straight up, for 60 seconds. So it's the first time they're actually going to get money back on this flight, by the way. Commercial flight. The group that's going up, that went up, is all from Italy. And they're actually doing a science experiment on the way up on this flight. And once they hit apogee, they experience about a minute or so of weightlessness. They get up to almost 3,000 miles per hour, which, sounds like a lot, but to reach orbit, you need to make it up to 17,500 miles an hour. It's up to almost 3,000. And to give you an idea, that launch I talked about before Euclid, to break the gravitational pull of Earth, They have to go around 25,000 miles per hour to do that. So this thing went 3,000 miles per hour, and that's what it's designed to do. It's a suborbital flight. Got up, well, it doesn't make it to the Kármán line, which is 62 kilometers or 60 miles, I think he said. But this one made it just past 50 miles, and that's good enough for United States. They recognize that you're an astronaut after 50 miles. Not that it affected the commander and the pilot. They've been up before, but the crew of four that was flying with them actually become astronauts, even, so they're not going into orbit. They are, and it's a suborbital flight. That's what they do. And the one guy, again, they were all from Italy, but the one guy from Italy, this guy Walter Billy Aldi, is also going to go up on another flight, and he will go to orbit, but he's going up on a SpaceX mission, four or five months now, or less, if SpaceX could do it, on the AX-3 mission. That's an Axiom mission. Another private mission. Docked to the International Space Station, from 10 to 12 days, and then return similar to the other two Axiom missions that have already gone to the space station. So, there's daredevils. I mean, this guy, not happy enough just going up on a suborbital flight, he's going to be going up on another commercial flight as well, up to the International Space Station. He'll get up to that 17,500 miles an hour. Any comments? WS2M. Nothing heard. Anyway, SpaceX has been in the news again recently, and this time a successful test of their next Starship vehicle. Starship has been launched back in April 20th. It was attached to the heavy booster that SpaceX has developed. SpaceX has 33 Raptor engines attached to that booster. The Starship itself has six Raptor engines. And each one produces, close to 500,000 pounds of thrust. So it's quite powerful. And they needed to first test the Starship. They put it on a orbital mount down in Boca Chica, Texas, and lit it up. And sure enough, it was successful. So now they could make plans on eventually mounting this whole Starship on top of the next heavy booster. And their plans are eventually to try again, maybe August. The last one failed. Made the news quite a bit. It went up. The two parts, the booster and the Starship itself, tried to separate, and that didn't work out. Didn't separate, and sure enough, they eventually used the FTS, the flight termination system, to destroy the rocket. That was supposed to go into, well, the booster was supposed to land back in the Gulf of Mexico. But the Starship was supposed to almost go into orbit, go all the way around the Earth, and somewhere around Hawaii, north of Hawaii, the Starship was supposed to deorbit and do a splash down in the Pacific Ocean. And they plan on having boats out there and planes and, record everything, see how it does. Their goal is to probably bring it down to the ocean and turn it vertical and see if it was landing on land, whether or not, there would be a shot of actually landing this back on solid surface. But we'll see how this eventually goes. The six engines on the back of Starship, three of them, are really used for powering up to orbit, and then once in orbit, the other three come on. They're considered vacuum engines. They have a bigger nozzle, a bigger bell on the back of it. And anytime they have that, it's considered a vacuum engine. Made to operate in a vacuum. It develops more thrust that way. So we'll see how Starship does. Anyway, they had a successful test with their 6 Raptor engines, and we'll see how they do. The problem is they're going to have to get the okay from the FAA. They're kind of mad at the man for the last time they blew their Starship up. So that's going to be a hurdle that I'm sure they're going to have to try to cross. They said 1,000 changes to the system, the booster, the Starship itself, for this launch. Some of the changes were planned before they tested the last one back in April 20th. But this time, one of the major changes, I know I mentioned it last week, it's called what do you call this thing? It's a hot staging system. That means hot staging. If they ignite the rocket, the upper stage, before it separates from the booster down below, which sounds dangerous. You have tanks down. You're going to have to. They're going to have to protect now. Do all kinds of work to protect the tanks on the heavy booster. Not only they don't want it to blow up, of course they don't want to damage it, because the heavy booster's goal is eventually to fly all the way back to Boca Chica and land vertically. So they got a lot of work ahead to try to make this thing an everyday occurrence, which is pretty much what they're going to have to do before NASA lets them ever get near their main goal of sending a Starship to lunar orbit, waiting for an Orion spacecraft to show up that was launched on a space launch system by NASA, and have an Orion dock with a Starship, and then having a crew transfer out there around the moon, and then having Starship vertically go all the way down to the moon and land on the moon, and have the crew come out, some kind of cabling system that I guess they're going to have to try to get the crew down from this 290-foot rocket down to the surface of the moon. Yeah, it's 1/6 gravity, but they can't jump out. And even if they did, how would they get back in? A lot has to be done here before they can do what they got to do. Also, to learn to land vertically, that's going to be another problem too. If you come down with these 6 engines and ignite even a couple of them to slow yourself down as you're going to hit the moon surface, aren't you going to hollow out create a crater below you? Maybe big enough where if you come down and land, the legs of your vertical Starship are not going to be level, and things going to tilt over. There's a lot of things that SpaceX has to really work out. I'm surprised NASA gave them a contract without knowing this yet. It's a set price, a couple billion dollars, whatever it was. And if it's a cost overrun and becomes a time and material job, then NASA's not responsible for it. That's okay. But to allow them to do what they're going to do and say they're going to be successful at it without, not evidence, but without being further into the Starship program. I was kind of surprised that NASA has always done things in redundancy. There's always double everything, double, triple safety for all the equipment that they use, especially for human spaceflight. But even the robotic flights, when you had the Pioneer spacecraft going out to Jupiter, there was Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11. One failed, the other one was the backup. They lucked out, both were good. The same for the Viking missions when they landed on Mars, back in the late 70s. You had Viking 1 and Viking 2. One landed on one side of the Mars, the other one on the other side of Mars. Redundancy. Voyager. There's Voyager 1 and 2. But when they came to this human landing system, they gave a contract out to SpaceX alone. You know, no backup. In other words, if SpaceX fails, now what do? You have a space launch system ready to go. You have a brand new second stage on the Centaur rocket ready to go with two, you know, completely redesigned. You got Orion spacecraft capable of carrying four people all the way to the moon. And then what's going to hang them up is SpaceX if they're not ready. And it don't look like they're going to be ready. So I think NASA finally realized what they did, and they managed to give another contract out for a human landing system. And at this time it went to Amazon and Lockheed. They plan on doing it with those two companies. Completely different landing system, very similar to LEM, except like three times bigger, you know, three or four times bigger than LEM. You know, again, land on the moon, big long legs. When the upper stage takes off, it's going to use the lower stage as a platform. You won't have this crater problem I don't see a way around it. I mean, they're talking about maybe some rockets off the side of Starship. Well, maybe they could land with that, you know, located higher up in the vehicle. You know, that's not even defined yet. We'll see. Time will tell. Any comments? Thought I heard Echo Link in there, but let me just stand by.
WB2BS.
Time complete.
Wasn't actually going to jump in, but as long as you offered, I can make a comment or so if you like.
Hey, Frank, very good. Yeah, I heard that little beep beep. I thought it was Echo Link. So I guess it wasn't you. Or I'm hearing things. That happens. How you doing, Frank? Back to you.
Yeah, very good. I mean, it's possible I accidentally teach something. Anyway, yeah, I just find the hot staging thing interesting. They're going back to sort of the strategy that Soyuz has used very successfully for many, many years, and that the N1 tried to use. Of course, the N1 got off the launch pad, but never made it into space. And I think the difference is, a major difference is they want to use hot staging and have the first stage be reusable. When Soyuz uses it, they don't care if they damage the first stage. It's going into the desert, probably in the case of Soyuz, or into the into the drink anyway. As you said, that sounds like a bit of a challenge. The only thing I can think of is that the first stage is going to drop off very, very quickly while the engine is firing. Anyway, that sounds like an extremely difficult feat to accomplish, but everything SpaceX does is extremely difficult, and they usually get it to work eventually. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm still trying to figure out the reason that he did that. I don't think it was the reason, you know, I mean, the second stage and the first stage did not separate last time. Starship was still attached when they eventually blew it up. So I don't think that was the reason, but they, you know, it might have been that they thought, well, if we had a hot staging, maybe it would have gotten separated. But the hot stage idea is also to create a smoother transition. Eventually you're going to have people on this thing, and one of the biggest shocks is when you separate different stages. You know, if you've seen the flights of the Apollo missions, you know, they especially the later ones, they had, you know, a very good film of the astronauts inside. Even now you can see it with some degree with a SpaceX Dragon launch. When the stages separate, you know, they instantaneously go to, no gravity, and then all of a sudden the second stage kicks in, And, you know, you see the astronauts get pushed forward and backwards. And, you know, it's quite a jump when any time you have stage separation. But with the Soyuz, you see it to some extent. You know, I've watched their launches, too. But it's not as severe because they do have that hot fire system. It's still pretty severe compared to what SpaceX wants to do, because with the Soyuz, they actually shut the engine down, the booster engine on the Soyuz. So they are creating that coasting action for temporarily no gravity, and then the hot stage kicks in, and then the two stages separate. What SpaceX wants to do is to keep it smooth. Is, you know, they're going to have the 33 engines on the first stage, on the heavy. And then as they're going up, they're going to cut back on them and only have maybe one or two going at the last minute, last few seconds. So the thrust will, you know, it will still be there, but it won't be zero. And then the hot stage will come on. The second stage will ignite, and then it will separate. So it should be a smoother transition for equipment and people, if they do that. Anyway, that's what I've been reading. We'll see how it works out, Frank. Back to you.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, that could be the main reason to do it, is because with, you know, as you said, smaller smoother transition and bounce large payloads, both people and freight around a lot less. But I mean, the Russians, you know, the Russian Soyuz booster is, I think, one of the most successful ever. I mean, the Soyuz design has been used since, what, the early 60s. And it's still in use, so, you know, maybe, I can say, maybe the idea is viable. Go ahead.
Yeah, what is the special effects?
I agree, and I'm sure you've seen it where you look at pictures of the Soyuz rocket. You know, you can bring it up on, I bring it up on Bing, and I get great pictures with Bing. You put down Soyuz rocket, and you look at the transition between the second stage and the first stage, and, you know, if there's like a cloud in the background, you can see daylight. It looks like they have this truss set up where you can actually see through it. So they have a way of, you know, when that thing ignites, you know, it's not igniting into a sealed cylinder, you might say. It's open already. SpaceX, they plan on having some kind of vents. They're talking about vents. So I'm imagining, you know, some kind of big panels or something on the side, which are going to probably move, open up, or, you know, some kind of system they're going to probably have. We'll see. Turn it back to you, Frank, and then, it's starting to get late already. WB2, BXO, WS2.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, we'll see what they do, but I guess it's going to be a while before we see another attempt at a Starship launch if they're completely redesigning this thing. I think in the end it's going to wind up looking a lot more like the Russian N1s we see in the Apple series For All Mankind. It is kind of ironic. Anyway, just to give you a chance to do anything else you wanted to cover and close it down for the night. WB2BX.
Okay, thanks for your comments, as always, Frank. Well appreciated. Yeah, I got a couple of things, but we can let them go. Nothing earth-shattering. And I'll just add that to the list for next week. Not a problem. Let me turn it over to you, Roy. Good net, and we'll be on again tomorrow night with the club net and the swap and shop. 8:30 on these repeaters. Roy, over to you. AC2GS, WS2N, for the Space Net report for the TechNet. Back to you.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the Space Net report. Thank you for all that you do here on the Technical Net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I especially appreciate your services here. And I appreciate everyone who participated tonight as well. As I mentioned before, you guys make or break these Technical Nets, so I'm glad you make them rather than break them. So please try and join me next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we do this all over again. I wish you all a safe and enjoyable 4th of July. Don't get yourselves blown up now. And as I often end these Technical Nets, I have a bunch of little quotes. Be kind to each other. Dick always used to end his Technical Nets. It's always good advice. It certainly is good advice these days. Like to mention hepatitis. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows, but try and keep your mind open and learn new things as time goes on. Our revels now are done, gentlemen and ladies. Again, I hope you have a safe 4th of July holiday, and please join me next Sunday night when we try and do this all over again. This is AC2GS, formally closing this episode of the Limark Technical Net. And I am clear. Slava Ukraine.
You're in, Slava.
Slava Ukraine, 73-WB2VX.
KD2VHD. Nice job, Roy, thank you. VHD still listening.
VHD into exchange.
Hello, Wesley. How are you?
Lava Ukraine, Matthew, Lava Ukraine, and this is your lava. Lava of your five viewers.
Understood. Yeah, there is certainly under duress there, no doubt. I'm curious, you were speaking about a device earlier, and I had no idea what you were talking about, but you seem to be talking about some sort of communication system that works over the electric line. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Signal Crafters is a company who made one of the first high-quality AWR power meters, had four connectors on the side, two connectors with the relay for the power amplifier, with output range from 1 watt to 1, up to 200 watts, and accuracy was about 6%, 1% less than BERT, but BERT is kind of limited, and that one had two displays. Actually 2 meters, and I went to the history of the company, which the company in the 80s made that device with directional coupler, and I was kind of surprised that directional coupler is used for such low frequency. So it was from 160 to 10 meters one device. Then I talked about the company making an equipment later on. So they started with ham radio stuff, and then later on they decided they're going to make similar devices to impedance matching for the devices they are communicating over the power line. So you have a 500 volt power line, and then from one station to the other station, which could be miles, 100 miles, they need to know that everything is good with it. And those devices are simply like the receiver and the transmitter. They either allow you to have perfect communication over the 500,000 volts transmission line, which is the power line, but it's now used as a transmission line, and it operates in 50 ohms. is the device by itself is 50 ohm in impedance. Now, there has to be some tuner that is tuning that piece of wire that is being used for the high voltage power line to that 50 ohm impedance of one from one side and from the other side. They also have 135 ohms